Mr. President, maybe you should just come clean.
I can't do that, Ron.
It's Greg.
Too many of these sons of bitches are out to get me. I want you to take what we have on this and deep six it. Am I clear?
Yes, Mr. President, but we're concerned that Pasniokas has something.
Who?
Pasniokas.
Who the hell is Pagliopas?
He's a journalist, Mr. President.
Commie Beard? I know the f***er you mean. He's out to get me. They all are, Stan. The Middleton people with their bubbly sangria and their scallion cilantro summer salad. They think they're better than me. I didn't grow up that way. We ate pieces of a cloth coat and we were happy to have anything.
Mr. President, I think we're getting a little far afield.
And I don't want that Jeff Cohen digging around in my garbage either. The public radio types with their French press coffee mugs and their messenger bags. They have no idea what goes on up here on the wall.
Mr. President, I've crafted a statement for you to give. I think it makes a clean breast of things without admitting too much.
Let me see. On or about July 17th, 2014, a car belonging to John Dankowski was dinged when the door of a car belonging to me was opened in a manner intended to protect the presidency. Alan, I can't say that. It puts me in the soup. What about, I can say categorically that our investigation indicates that no one on my staff, no one in this administration presently employed, was involved in this very bizarre car dinging accident.
That's not the truth.
I don't give a f- what happens. I want you to stonewall, plead the Fifth Amendment, cover up, or anything else, if that'll save me, Throckmorton.
Yes, Mr. President.
Here's what I want you to do. Go and get the other one. The other little bastard with the beard. Trevor Flabbergaster.
Tucker Ives.
Right. Take him out to Camp David, and don't let him leave until he's implicated himself. Okay? And now you can turn the tape machine back on.
It's been on, Mr. President.
Rosemary, get in here! The rest of you listen to this show about a third-rate burglary. And now he's still waiting in the parking garage for Bob Woodward. Colin McEnroe.
I am. I'm prepared to tell Bob Woodward everything I know. And I've been standing here in this parking garage for 40 years almost. More than 40 years, I guess it would be. So I just have to say before we begin this conversation, it was my idea to do a show about Watergate. Obviously, we're coming up on a major 40th anniversary, the anniversary of the resignation itself. Now that I'm into it, I realize I have no idea how to talk about Watergate, even though it consumed a portion of my early life, my life as an adolescent and my first years in college, because it really is one of these stories that flaps around so much that it doesn't really have a beginning and a middle and an end. We think it does, but it doesn't. However, what we're going to do really today is to talk about how to talk about something like Watergate, how difficult it is to talk about it, and how the way we talk about it changes over time, and various efforts that are made to throw some kind of narrative bridle over this bucking bronco of a story. So before we do any of that, and before I introduce our guests, we did send two of our finest interns out onto the street. Britt Hill and Allison Ehrenreich roamed the streets of somewhere asking people what they remember about Watergate.
What do you remember about Watergate?
Nixon. I would say people still think he's a dirty liar, but I think we've started realizing that politicians are kind of all like that, and it's just whether or not they get caught. The Watergate Hotel, you know, the phone tapping.
Richard Nixon was involved. The guy broke into an office, he stole some papers, and he called himself, I don't know, a little before my time.
I guess I know a decent amount about it, as much as somebody who was born a decade after the Watergate scandal happened would know.
Nothing.
All right. In just a little while. By the way, I think that's pretty typical, what you just heard, but it's not for me to say. It's for our guests, really. In a little while, you'll meet Ed Gray. He's one of the things we'll talk about today is sort of living memory and then living memory as it's passed on to others. Ed Gray is the son of former FBI Director L. Patrick Gray, and he's the co-author of In Nixon's Web, A Year in the Crosshairs of Watergate. You're going to meet him in a little while. He would be one of those figures that if you didn't live through Watergate, you might not remember or know. I'm talking about L. Patrick Gray, but we'll come to that in just a second. It just so happens that our two guests here at the start of the show are two writers who I can genuinely say I have just admired their work so much, and it has made left a very good mark on me over time. Thomas Mallon is with us. He's a novelist and critic, author of many novels, including my beloved Henry and Clara, as well as a whole bunch of other novels, most of which I've read and all of which I've enjoyed when I have read them. His most recent, Watergate, is in fact a novelistic retelling of the story. He is joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. And then Michael Shudson. Michael Shudson's book, Watergate in American Memory, How We Remember, Forget, and Reconstruct the Past, is a book which I have lugged from job to job, from place to place. I wouldn't dream of trying to talk about Watergate without it. I would add to that that his other work is of a similar caliber. I actually think that nobody should try to write about American elections or politics without reading The Good Citizen, which is his history of American civic life and sort of how we have come to believe what we believe about things like voting. He's a sociologist and historian and professor of journalism at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Hope I got that right. And so we're going to begin here. We're going to finally actually start talking about this. And Thomas Mallon, I'm going to start with you. And I'm going to quote to you one of your fellow novelists who attempted to do a similar thing, and that's Don DeLillo, just in the way that your book is a very interesting retelling and necessary retelling of the Watergate story. DeLillo, as we know, retold the story of the Kennedy assassination in a book called Libra. And at one point, one of his protagonists, a CIA agent who's trying to make some kind of sense of this enormous midden of information and documentation and analysis and forensic detail. He talks about what a conspiracy really is. He says it's a rambling affair that succeeded in the short term due mainly to chance, deft men and fools, ambivalence and fixed will, and what the weather was like. And I sense a little bit of that approach in your novel Watergate, Thomas Mallon, this sense that, you know, we want to see it as this coherent narrative, but really it's sort of a bunch of people kind of bouncing off each other in ways that ultimately ruined lives and tore down the reputation of a president.
I think that's true. I think that there's a great deal of accident and fate that operates in history. I think this is one of the reasons that conspiracy believers who don't want to believe in those things, accident and fate, are so tenacious. But I think they often upset the apple cart. And I think things happen for reasons that are preposterous. And Watergate, I think, is one of them. There certainly was a deliberate crime that was committed in Watergate by a small original conspiracy that almost certainly, and even John Dean will agree with this, did not include Richard Nixon. But then the conspiracy to cover it up grew and grew and grew and grew. And what I've always tried to do in fiction is show how political events, catastrophes and so forth, affect people personally. You know, there's that phrase, the personal is political, an old 60s phrase. I think in some ways my mantra for writing historical fiction has been the political is personal. Try to show what it does to individuals, not try to rewrite history in fiction, not try to show, you know, an alternate history as some novels do, have the South win the Civil War, things like that, but show what might have happened in addition to what we actually know, things that happened within the cracks.
So we're going to add Michael Shudson to this conversation right away, but I'm going to ask you a Michael Shudson question. I mean, obviously, why did you write this novel? Well, you wanted to write a novel. It's one of the things you do. You write novels. You write novels that often feature real historical people in them. But Michael Shudson, at least in his pursuit of the way that we understand Watergate and collective memory, would want to know, what else did you want to do, Thomas Mallon? What did you have some general purpose beyond the fact that you just write novels the way people climb mountains? Did you have some general purpose in framing Watergate any particular way?
I had no set moral thesis, which I think is deadly for any kind of fiction, historical or otherwise. One is likely to emerge as you write. I think, you know, a message, which sounds sort of pompous, but nonetheless, it does sort of bubble up as you actually work. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to show how certain relatively minor figures may have experienced Watergate, and then also to show a somewhat different view of the Nixons themselves, especially Mrs. Nixon, who was not the plastic Pat of American caricature, was a much more interesting, much tougher person than that. And to some extent, Nixon himself, who was multidimensional, had a tremendous dark side, but was a man of enormous political gifts, even intellectual gifts to some extent. He would not have interested me, if he was just a rubber Nixon mask, if he was some cardboard villain. That wouldn't have appealed to me as a novelist. So I was trying in a way to bring out different dimensions of them from the usual ones, and also to show some of these minor characters, but above all to entertain readers. There are comic aspects to the book, although I wouldn't call it a comedy, but fundamentally to tell a good story and let the reader discern whatever messages might be there.
Michael Schutzen, as you listen to this, Thomas Mann's novel, Watergate, a novel, came out, I think, exactly 20 years after your historical book about Watergate in collective American memory. Yours was in 1992. His was in 2012. You know, even in your book, 20 years before his, you're exploring this question. One of the things you explore is, how many books can there be about Watergate? I think you invoke Russell Baker, who at one point had a column about a book called The Last Watergate Book that was written by Richard Nixon's masseur or somebody like that. One senses that the answer is there'll never be a last Watergate book, right? We're still somehow or other processing this, like Russian nesting dolls, stories within stories within stories. We're still trying to figure out what actually this story is. Are you surprised to find out that a major American novelist in 2012 was writing a Watergate novel?
I was surprised. I read it too, and it works wonderfully as entertainment. I enjoyed every second of it. But I think it works. I mean, as a novel, because Thomas Mann made it his own. I mean, if you know nothing about Watergate, I would think it would work well. It's a very entertaining, interesting book. That to have lived through Watergate just made it additionally delicious. As names came back into focus that you hadn't thought much about, you vaguely remembered just because they were at the edge of scenes of the Watergate investigation itself.
Thomas Mann, one of the things that we're going to talk about here a little bit is this whole question of living memory. And, you know, every year somebody dies, right? Somebody dies who was a key figure in Watergate. Howard Baker died recently. That means that Lowell Weicker here in Connecticut, I think, is the only surviving member of the Watergate Senate committee. I think I'm correct about that. But and in writing this, how much did that factor for you become a factor for you? How much did you care whether certain people were either alive or not alive, or and therefore either prepared to dispute or not prepared to dispute things that you said?
Well, I was usually glad if I discovered they were dead, because it always, I mean, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, that's going to give you a much freer hand. There are a few living principals of the Watergate scandal who are still around. John Dean, who's just written a new book. Gordon Liddy is still around. I think he's still on the radio, and I see him on television commercials. And a few others, Woodward and Bernstein, on the journalistic side of it, are still there. I didn't want to focus on them because not really just because they were living and, I would have to worry about their reactions to things, but they were all people who had told their own stories, had written their own books. It's true that the number of books is absolutely enormous. I mean, this is one of the only projects I've ever worked on where I wished there was less material to consult. I mean, you have the tapes, you have all of the transcripts of the investigations, and you have this shelves of memoirs that just about everybody wrote, sometimes just to pay their legal bills. They were writing memoirs before even the resignation. But as a novelist, you do want a free hand. You operate different from a historian. A historian or biographer will say, you know, at this moment, it is not unreasonable to think that Richard Nixon might have thought, whereas if you're a novelist, you just go ahead and have him think it. You just go ahead and have him say it. And not that I want to discourage people from reading my novel. I don't. But I would urge people like those people you interviewed on the street at the beginning of the program, people who really want to know a book, know what happened in Watergate, I would urge them to read books like Michael's book first, because, as I say in one of the afterwords to one of my novels, in fact, I think it's Henry and Clara, that one you mentioned, you know, it's important to remember that nouns always trump adjectives. And in the phrase historical fiction, fiction is the noun. You know, I'm always a bit leery when people come up to me and they say, oh, I learned so much history from your book. I always want to say, well, be careful, because, you know, some of it's been manipulated and it's been put through the mill of fiction. And the result is very different. I'd be horrified if my book was the only book that somebody read who was interested in Watergate.
And would you be horrified also, and this will lead us back to Michael Schudson quite nicely, do you feel there's some kind of obligation to keep this story alive and for people to remember? I mean, does it matter if 10 years from now, when it's the 50th anniversary, you know, we go out in the streets and people even have less of a clue of what Watergate was? Will that matter to you? Do you think it's important for the United States or for history or for whatever?
Is that for me?
Yeah, it's for you. And then I'm going to go over to Michael Schudson about this because it's right up his alley.
I'm not sure it matters more than a lot of other events that Americans don't know much about. You know, if you quiz them on the Constitution, if you quiz them on events of the Civil War, Second World War, they might know even less. But certainly I think Watergate has a kind of relevance. It has a kind of relevance in dealing with the psychology of all sorts of people who get involved in politics. And I also think the question that sometimes proceeds from the one you're asking, will there ever be another Watergate? And my answer to that would be absolutely yes. It won't involve burglary. When you go back to this scandal, which seemed so high tech at the time, bugging devices, tape recordings, whatever, you know, it now seems very primitive. And yet, the impulse to spy on your opponents remains evergreen among politicians. And I think there most certainly will be another Watergate, but it will take, you know, an electronic form. I mean, one of the things I know is that Richard Nixon would have loved the internet. It was right up his street. I mean, he the connection from one thing to another, the ability to furrow in, to hack in, to do, Nixon was a great aggregator of information and a great processor of it. So I think Watergate is useful still to know about because it may well prefigure something as big or even worse.
Well, you know, actually, Thomas Mallon, you've led me to a different question to ask Michael Schudson, that whole question of will there ever be another Watergate? And Michael Schudson, it depends, I think, on what we mean by Watergate and what we think Watergate is. This is something you explore in the book. For some people, it's the story of this horrible man, this modern-day Richard III, this guy who got into office and did these terrible things that would have been previously unthinkable. And for a lot of other people, it's the story of the imperial president. Itself, the fact that the American presidency wasn't what people thought it was, hadn't been for a long time what people thought it was. And I would wonder whether it would be possible for there to be that kind of a Watergate now, because, in fact, over the last 40 years, people have grown even more accustomed to the notion that the American presidency wasn't what people thought it was, say, in the era that preceded Richard Nixon. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the general question here about could there be another Watergate, I actually think there was. It was called Iran-Contra at the time in the Reagan administration. And it was another Watergate in the sense that it was the president and people very close to the president acting without normal congressional approval and without public oversight and without media attention. The Iran-Contra affair was broken and became public because of a weekly Lebanese magazine that revealed it. It was not the American press.
And it came off in the end as less cataclysmic than Watergate, I think only because it was about foreign policy. And the presidency and the president are is just granted by the public in general and by, you know, constitutional precedent, more leeway to run things as he chooses. Even so, I'm not, I don't think we've had another domestic Watergate in which the president or his associates or both are involved in really interfering with the normal electoral process in a whole series of what were famously called at the time dirty tricks. It can repeat itself. It has in some ways repeated itself at the time. I mean, the year or two after Watergate, there was great concern in the Congress to remember Watergate legislatively because they knew people wouldn't remember it in their own individual minds. So just I'll stop this ramble in a moment here, but Senator Weicker of Connecticut at the time, urging legislative reform, said, this is 1975, the American people will forget. It is not a hard political issue anymore. The issues will fade away in the distance. We can sit here and we can remember what has happened, and we will make sure it will not happen again. But what about those children who are unborn and 50 years from now have had no relationship whatsoever with these events? Well, in fact, people didn't, for the most part, understand Watergate even at the time very well. And of course, it's disputed. Certainly the details of it are disputed. But it did fade. It was a Washington affair. It wasn't a war that people experienced in their own communities or homes because their fathers or brothers or sisters went off to battle. It took place within the Washington Beltway, and it was remote. It was interesting. It was theatrical, but it was remote from most people's everyday lives.
You know, one of the things that your book actually points out is that in polling at the time, the rest of America seemed more concerned about the oil crisis and the rising price of gas than they did about Watergate. Although I think also as things kind of unfolded on television and people began watching these proceedings, Watergate began to contest for people's attention in a slightly different way anyway, as a story maybe. I actually remember my father, who had been a lifelong Goldwater Republican, or at least a Republican with eventual Goldwater leanings, watching the hearings and saying just out loud, muttering to himself, these people are evil, they're evil. I mean, it absolutely changed his outlook. He became politically a very different person as a result of Watergate. But Michael Shetson, I wonder...
Senator Goldwater.
So does Senator Goldwater, right. So Michael Shetson, I want to ask you sort of a follow-up question to that. All right, so you mentioned Iran-Contra, and I remember Iran-Contra well enough to know that really at that point, Watergate really was this kind of benchmark of wrongdoing so that things tended to get compared to it. So when there were debates about Iran-Contra, one of the ways it would be debated was, well, was it as bad as Watergate? No, it's not as bad as it was Watergate. Oh, yes, it is. It's just as bad as Watergate. So Watergate sort of stood for bad, and then things were either just as bad or worse or better or whatever. And that probably continued to Iraqgate, which people really barely remember, but even got a gate attached to it, and maybe on into Whitewater and maybe on to the Monica Lewinsky situation for Bill Clinton. But I think as we moved into this new century, that I think Watergate as a benchmark, as something against which another scandal could be measured, did begin to lose a little bit of its power in that regard. How would you react to that statement?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it. I mean, with Iran-Contra, which was just a dozen years later, it was absolutely over and over and over again. How is this like? How is this unlike Watergate? It was very much the framework, and And Watergate at that point still had such a hold, at least for Washington and key decision makers on the political imagination, that, and you can make an argument, and some people did at the time, that Iran-Contra did not get treated with the seriousness it by rights deserved, because it was being compared to this cataclysm of a constitutional crisis. That's not going to happen again. Watergate is too far in the past. Watergate's also in some ways too complicated, if you get into the details of it, to make a very useful comparison. It's only a kind of broad metaphorical comparison, mostly in that in the way it's changed our language, and we have this gate suffix. It gets used all over the world.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more Thomas Mallon, more Michael Schudson, a little bit later also. We'll be talking about Watergate today, often in terms of people and how people either curate or besiege certain kinds of memories. We'll talk to his son, who is trying to address some of the injustices he feels were directed at the memory of his father. All right, we are back. Let me tell you who we're talking to. We're talking to Thomas Mallon. He's a novelist and critic. He's known for novels like Dewey Defeats Truman and Henry and Clara, and most recently Watergate, a novel. And he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington. Michael Schudson is a sociologist and historian. His indispensable book about Watergate is called Watergate in American Memory. And the subtitle is How We Remember, Forget, and Reconstruct the Past. In a little while, we'll also talk to Ed Gray. He's the son of Pat Gray, the former FBI chief, also involved in ways that probably he didn't want to be in Watergate. We'd be happy to hear from you, too, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. So, Thomas Mallon, you attempted to tell this story in the form of a novel. You did tell the story in the form of a novel. But I guess what I want to know is, as you sat down to tell it that way, did you feel ultimately as though you have enough of a grasp of this weird, sprawling, octopus-like story so that you could sit down with a 22-year-old person today and in, you know, 2 or 3 minutes explain Watergate to them? Do you feel like you know what this story is?
Not completely, not perfectly by any means. I mean, the book actually comes with a cast of characters, you know, a long list of the dramatis personae in the front, because I think readers actually, including readers who lived through it, need to refer back to that at times, because the cast of characters ultimately grew so large. And this is a story that took, you know, more than 2.5 years to unfold, really 3 or 4, because Watergate has its roots in other things within the Nixon administration. And it was, to some extent, epic. To some other extent, it was claustrophobic. As Michael was saying, it was a Washington story to a great extent. And its ramifications were huge, but the things that it actually involved, the actual wrongdoing, was sometimes so small, so petty, so trivial. Pat Nixon in my book thinks at one point Watergate was enormous, colossal, and it was nothing. And I think one thing, too, to go back to what you were talking about with Michael a few minutes ago, I think it's also important not to overestimate Watergate's importance in American history and Watergate's relevance to political life today. I don't think that ultimately what happened in terms of Watergate crimes disrupted the electoral process of 1972. And I do think what was at issue, I'm writing about the novel I'm working on right now is about the late Reagan years, and Iran-Contra figures largely in it. And I do think what was at issue in Iran-Contra was much more serious than what was at issue in Watergate, much more fundamental about the balance of power between the presidency and the Congress. I think another real difference between those two scandals, why did Iran-Contra recede and why did Reagan survive, whereas Watergate, if it was less serious, why did that bring down Nixon, has a lot to do with the personalities of the two men. The public was prepared to accept an apology from Ronald Reagan, which he ultimately delivered. He didn't deliver it as soon as many people wanted to, and they were prepared to accept his excuse that he was confused about it and didn't really know the full implications of what he was doing. That's an excuse that no one would ever have accepted from Richard Nixon, who had the persona of a prosecutor, who had the persona of somebody who was always on top of details. It had also to do with the temperament of the two men. Nixon and Reagan are in touch with each other quite a bit during the fall of 1986. They're on the phone pretty often. Reagan valued Nixon's advice. And one of the things that I think is poignant and interesting is in the early days of Iran-Contra, late in 86, well before the investigations are fully underway in 87 within the Congress, Nixon's advice to Reagan is to apologize, to get it behind him. In other words, do what I failed to do early on, take responsibility for it and move ahead. Once Reagan did that, to a great extent, any impetus to get rid of him began to collapse.
We're talking to Thomas Mallon and to Michael Shudson. We're going to be taking some phone calls, and in a second we will add to this conversation Ed Gray, who's the son of Pat Gray. My mind is going so many different places, I may not be able to phrase this next question. But Michael Shudson, it seems to me one of the really interesting things about the post-Watergate story of Watergate is this question that you explore in the book of who curates it, right? Who gets to tell it? Who has to tell it? And for a while, the answer is everybody. And one of the things that I've noticed recently, and it reminds me a little bit of the dictum that as things die out, there's an even bigger effort to kind of celebrate them and honor them or make a big deal out of them among certain people. These days, I saw Bob Woodward on stage a couple of years ago. He mentioned while on stage that he still keeps Watergate tapes in his car and he listens to them as he's driving around Washington. John Dean was on this radio station sometime within the last 6 months or so, and he's kind of doing his equivalent of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, where he just goes around and gives these multimedia presentations about Watergate. And you realize that now it does seem as though there's this kind of rear guard of people who, for one reason or another, have a real investment in this story. And they're starting to seem a little bit superannuated. I mean, there's something about this now that's it does seem more like museum curation and less like the living embodiment of history. And does it make you think that once again we're coming to a terminus, to an end of the energy of this story?
Yes, I think we are. As I was looking back at this in preparation to talk with you today, I was struck in the immediate post-Watergate year or two as the Congress was considering a variety of proposals to keep a closer eye on misdeeds in the executive branch of government, I was writing this book to confront some issues about how societies in general remember their past. What is cultural memory? Is there such a thing as collective memory? And so on. And I was quite struck by the members of Congress who were dealing with exactly that question. Some of them said, well, we could be this was a really unusual circumstance, and if we're going to pass laws based on this weird mess of a scandal, we may be passing laws that could have negative consequences and really not apply to anything like Watergate. And there probably won't be something exactly like Watergate. So we're gonna write the wrong laws, said some, and others said, well, that could be, but we have to do something. This was a a real crisis. And if we don't do something, we know that individual memories are not going to keep these lessons in mind. We went through this, two years of it in Washington, more than 2 years. Our children are not going to have that same experience. Why should they? Who curates this over time? Watergate is, in a way, it's remembered not by individuals. It's remembered by language, that great suffix gate. It's remembered by other kinds of language. What did he know, and when did he know it? Dirty tricks, deep six, all these things. Some of those are passing already, but our common language is a crucial form of memory, and Watergate has still a strong legacy there. And in some laws, I wouldn't minimize the importance of the Ethics in Government Act and revisions of the Freedom of Information Act that would not have happened without Watergate, or the Inspectors General Act, 1978. These were all there was a range of legislative efforts to say we have to hold in our common legal system a memory that individuals are simply not going to be able to do themselves.
I sort of wonder about even those things. Right now here in Connecticut, we're seeing a lot of those reforms being under attack, both from legislators and from the governor's office here. And every once in a while when I'm inveighing about this, I'll talk about these things as the post-Watergate reforms, the reforms that became so obviously necessary as a result of Watergate. And then I realize that this is an incredibly evocative way to me to talk about it, but to some 38-year-old staffer in the legislature or in the governor's office, it's probably a fairly empty piece of rhetoric. I'll tell you one phrase that did survive, and because it's so useful. It's not the crime, it's the cover-up. That was used as recently as Chris Christie and the bridge closing. It was used about Martha Stewart. Talk about it. That is a trope that probably will, it may even outlive the gate, the trope of the gate suffix to things, maybe just because it's so incredibly true.
Yeah, you're right. That's been a very enduring one.
We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to have more Michael Schutzen, more Thomas Mallon, and you're going to meet Ed Gray, co-author of In Nixon's Web, A Year in the Crosshairs of Watergate.
There was a big committee to elect the president. I'll tell you now, they were a smooth group. Where they broke into Watergate and tapped people's phones. The FBI and CIA would not leave folks alone. The people in the White House were bursting with pride. When the votes were all counted, it was a big landslide. The USA bought a new used car.
They say G. Gordon Liddy would hold a hand over a candle longer than anyone else could stand to. He said the trick is not minding. Well, I've been holding my hand over a candle this whole time. What's that? His candle was actually lit? Oh. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Katie Pikus and Britt Hill. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ron Ziegler. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff breaking into the Brookings Institute and leaving piles of dirty underwear on all the desks, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our salute to the accordion. And now, back to Colin.
So we're going to do one more segment here about Watergate as we head down the home stretch here. We want to thank Michael Schutzen, his incredible book, Watergate in American Memory. Although there were certain things that were not available when Michael Schutzen was writing that book, including Wikipedia. Now, as Alan Yu, our old friend Alan Yu, who's listening right now in Hong Kong, reminds us, there's now on Wikipedia an entry that simply chronicles all of the scandals. 200 scandals with gate suffixes that have at least been nominally applied to them. So Michael Schutzen, first of all, I commend that Wikipedia entry to your attention. I'll try to get you a free copy of Thomas Mallon's Iran-Contra novel when it comes out. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure.
All right. We're going to move along here to Ed Gray, and Thomas Malin will, I think, have some things to say to him, and they'll have some things to say to each other. Ed Gray is the co-author of In Nixon's Web, A Year in the Crosshairs of Watergate. His father, Pat Gray, will have said several times who he was. But let me read from a quote from one of my old friends, a man I've come to think of as a friend anyway, Lowell Weicker, who's talking about Pat Gray. And he says, he's talking about just living down by the shore. It brings up for me the memory of Pat Gray, who was a submarine commander and who lived up here in eastern Connecticut. Gray was a decorated war hero. He commanded a submarine when, believe me, a submarine was dangerous, dangerous duty. He was a great man and a great hero. He was used, and his life was ruined by Richard Nixon when he appointed Patrick Gray as temporary head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and used him in that role to suppress evidence of the Watergate scenario. So, Ed Gray, I'm assuming that the words of Senator Weicker resound for you and are very close to the way that you understand the story of your father and of Watergate.
Well, that's true. I mean, Lowell Weicker and my dad were great friends, apart from the relationship they had during the Watergate, and remained great friends for great times. For a long time, I was really pleased to hear Lowell still repeating that. But you know, what Lowell said is about my father's getting involved with Richard Nixon, essentially ruining his professional life, was certainly exactly what my father said. It's what he said during the entirety of the book that I finished for him after he died in 2005. I don't have much more to say about that, except that, you know, I mean, the problem is, as you know, you and Michael and Thomas have been discussing today, is that, you know, the Watergate itself is a sort of a trope. It's a narrative that exists in various levels of memory and importance for all of us. And you know, but you know, the problem is, you know, as you were discussing, what about the people 10 years from now? Is it, you know, or the people who, you know, your 38-year-old staffer today? I mean, what, you know, when you say Watergate and the lessons thereof that we need to carry with us, you know, how do you boil that down? I mean, what is, you know, what's the, you know, the sort of elevator pitch version of the Watergate story for somebody today?
I asked my 24-year-old son that question, and I was actually surprised at the amount of grasp he had of it. I was more than I would have guessed that he had. But I think it's a great question. Before we get to that question, though, I want to go back to Thomas Malin for a second, because I do think this is a place where you and Ed Gray kind of touch. You overlap, at least. Correct me if I'm wrong, Thomas Malin, but there's kind of a sense of Watergate in your novel that it could take a relatively benign person, a relatively, you know, morally sound person, and somehow or other whirl him around like a whirlwind until he was something else, or at least he was going to be forever understood as something else. I mean, were you able to think deeper into that question, how it could be the case that people who were not necessarily bad people or inclined towards criminal or illegal activities wound up doing things like that?
Oh, I think that happens to people who get involved in political life all the time. I think it's part of the nature of power. It's part of the nature of the combat of politics. There were people, I mean, we haven't mentioned Sam Ervin, who was the head of the Senate committee that investigated Watergate in 73. And one of the early witnesses before the Ervin committee was a young man named Hugh Sloan, who was the treasurer for the committee to reelect the president, CREEP as it was called. And Sloan had gotten enmeshed in what was going on, the finances of it, and was called to testify, and was rather, you know, upset and regretful about things that had happened. He was very quickly in over his head, and he told what had happened. And Senator Ervin, you know, who quoted scripture a lot, said to him, basically kind of absolved him and said, you know, an honest man is the noblest work of God. And Sloan came away from Watergate fine. I'm not trying to imply he did anything seriously wrong, but I think people who what my old mentor, Mary McCarthy, used to call the conflict between excited scruples and inertia of will occurs all the time in politics when you know that what you're about to do is wrong, but there are tremendous pressures on you to do it. I think you even see that in somebody who ultimately is a much more, I suppose, sinister figure like Howard Hunt, whom I actually knew slightly toward the end of his life. And Hunt, who had been a CIA agent and then became one of the plumbers and then became one of the architects of the break-in, Hunt did some service to his country, some genuine service to his country early in his life. And as time went on, became incapable of making distinctions as to what was legal, what was illegal, what was proportionate, what was disproportionate, and became involved, you know, in some spectacular wrongdoing. But even Hunt, I don't think, is this black and white figure, this figure of pure villainy. And certainly from a novelist's point of view, that's the kind of person you become interested in writing about.
I think I need to break in here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Pretty quickly. You know, you describe people like Hugh Sloan and Howard Hunt as those who got caught in the whirlwind of these events and became either consciously or subconsciously a person they weren't. That was not my father. The problem he faced is that he did not go along with that. You know, when
I didn't mean to imply that. If you took
no,
that as an implication,
I just wanted to really clarify it because it's an enduring false echo, if you will, from the Watergate. That you know, my father was one of the 12 or 13, I forget which, people whose faces were on the dust jacket of the original hardcover edition of All the President's Men. Every single other one of those people either pled guilty or was convicted of a Watergate crime. My father wasn't even indicted. He, you know, his problem was that the Nixon people who were all involved in the cover-up couldn't make him do, as the director of the FBI, what they wanted him to do.
Although the enduring image of your father, for better or worse, is if an image endures, it may well be the image of him at the fireplace in Stonington burning these things from Howard Hunt's file, not all of them having to do with Nixon, many of them apparently, we think, having to do with the previous presidents, Kennedy and Johnson. So how did he explain that moment? I'm sorry for asking you that question.
No, go ahead. No, I can explain it very carefully because— You know, it was a subject of a major criminal investigation. They thought that the prosecutors thought that he might have committed a crime, and after years of investigation, literally, they determined no, he hadn't, because those documents that were given to him by John Ehrlichman and John Dean early in the investigation, after Dean had opened Howard Hunt's safe in the White House and pulled out all this Watergate stuff and gave that to the FBI, he also pulled out some other documents, which apparently were forgeries of fake cables from the JFK era and some other sort of false stuff that they had dug up on Teddy Kennedy and Chappaquiddick. They pulled those things out, put them in sealed envelopes, and gave them to my father. And said, you know, we've complied with the investigation. We've turned over all of the Watergate related stuff to your agents in the FBI. But this stuff has absolutely nothing to do with the Watergate. This is true national security, State Department classified stuff, and it can never see the light of day. So my father, who had been privy to the highest levels of secrecy in the government, for many years prior to this, understood what that meant. Mm-hmm. That meant that stuff should never see the light of day. So he did. He took it to Connecticut eventually, only because he didn't realize he was so new in the FBI at the time. He didn't know that the red wastebasket under his desk was a burn box. So instead of throwing them in there, he took them with him up to Connecticut and burned them up there.
Ed Gray, we're going to have to stop there. I know this is a much longer story, and I apologize for our lack of time. Ed Gray is the co-author of the book In Nixon's Web, In the Crosshairs of Watergate. So many thanks to Thomas Mallon. Can't wait for the Iran-Contra book. And to Michael Shudson. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan for pulling all this together. Kyone Wolf for making us sound good. And we'll be back tomorrow with accordions.
Don't let the sun go down on me, yeah.
Mr. President, the tape is still rolling.
I know. I'm hoping Elton John and I can do a duet.
And maybe you should sing Sorry Seems to Be the Hardest Word.
What did you say?
Nothing.